It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, new documents from a civil complaint against the drug company Purdue Pharma are shedding light on how it marketed the opioid painkiller OxyContin. We'll find out about Purdue's relationship with doctors and why it considered getting into the business of addiction treatment. First, the issue of how we should tax the wealthiest Americans has been front and center lately after a variety of proposals from lawmakers. Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez recently suggested raising marginal income tax rates for people at the highest income levels. And Senator Elizabeth Warren is proposing an annual wealth tax of 2% on people with net worth over $50 million and 3% for fortunes over $1 billion. On the other side of the aisle, Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell is backing a bill that would end the estate tax, which is already narrowed in 2017's tax overhaul bill. With all of these ideas out there, we're taking a look at what impact they might have, what's been effective in the past, and what's possible today. Caroline Bruckner is the managing director of the COGOD Tax Policy Center at American University. Caroline, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we get into some of the details here, why do you think this has become such a hot topic of conversation in early 2019?
I think because the polling is so good. Both Fox News and Politico have done recent polling of everyday Americans on what they think about raising taxes on the wealthy. And the numbers are pretty high in the double digits that most Americans feel comfortable with trying to raise taxes on wealthy folks.
Now, it looks simple in some ways when we talk about, okay, raise or lower taxes on wealthy people. But it's pretty complicated as I start to dig into it more. There's the tax rates, sure. There's various kinds of loopholes and shelters. How difficult an issue is this to sort out?
Well, it can be as simple or as complicated as you make it. So if you just want to raise rates, that can be very simply done. We have always adjusted marginal tax rates fairly regularly to either raise taxes on most Americans or lower taxes on most Americans. And keep in mind that the marginal tax rates that were cut a little bit as part of the tax reform bill, they weren't changed all that much. The brackets didn't change all that much. It's just the marginal tax rates were just cut a little bit. So the 39.6% top tax rate went down to 37% in the most recent effort. And so it's not really that challenging to just change rates. Now, what Elizabeth Warren is talking about doing is instituting a whole brand new tax. And that's where it gets really complicated.
Let's start with the marginal tax rate. First of all, can you explain how that works? Because sometimes you see a number like 70%, and just glancing at it, you think, wow, you're going to take 70% of everything that person makes over the course of a year. No, talk about how marginal tax rates work, please.
Right. So we have a progressive tax system, which means that we tax income as it's accumulated. Your wage income typically is the way most Americans have income at progressive rates that progressively increase as your income goes up. So everybody pays, say, for example, 10%, which is the marginal tax rate on their first $9,000, and then assuming that you're a single taxpayer. And then everybody pays 12% on amounts they earn between $9,000 and $38,000, and then 22% on amounts between 82% and 38,000 and 82,000, so on and so forth. But the top tax rate is 37%. And that is, so for amounts that anyone earns in any given year over $500,000, if you're a single person, you pay a 37% tax rate just on those amounts. It's not a flat tax rate. You don't earn, say, $500,000 and pay $37,000 on that entire $500,000 amount.
Mm-hmm. And how does that top marginal tax compare historically with what we've seen in the United States?
Well, I mean, as recently as 1980, we did have a top tax rate of 70%. Reagan was elected on a platform of vowing to cut individual tax rates, and he worked with Democrats to create bipartisan legislation to do so. So it's, you know, historically tax rates have been much higher than where they are now. And, you know, where that's really reflected is when you look at when you look at how much of our revenue, overall revenue as a percentage of GDP, is attributable to individual tax rates. And when you look at it on that basis of comparison, you see that today, relative to what we paid in the past, the revenue that the taxes that we pay are far less relative to GDP than they have been in a long, long time.
Talking to Caroline Bruckner from American University, looking at various plans, ideas about taxes on wealthier Americans. Caroline, one common objection brought up is, okay, you raise the marginal rates for wealthier Americans. They will find ways, loopholes, things like that, to avoid paying at those rates, or it'll be a disincentive for them to do money, do things that make that much money. So does it really work the way it's intended?
I don't think the economic evidence necessarily shows that to be true. I think that the economy has certainly thrived in instances where there have been much higher tax rates, and it is certainly starting to, or at least CBO's most recent projections show that at a time where our tax rates have been cut and will be from now through 2025, because remember, the tax reforms bill's individual tax cuts are only effective through 2025. And their CBO's most recent projections, and that's the Congressional Budget Office that does all sorts of economic projections on economic growth, they're showing that actually growth is going to slow over that same period.
Now let's turn to the idea of the wealth tax. You mentioned Senator Elizabeth Warren talking about that on people worth over $50 million and then a higher tax rate over $1 billion. What kind of revenue would an idea like that raise?
Well, it's interesting because she has actually put out she has actually looked to other groups that have proposed similar wealth taxes, a 1% wealth tax on households over 32 million, for example, could raise $1.3 trillion over a 10-year period. And that's, you know, a different proposal that was put out by the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. So, you know, there are groups who have looked at similar proposals that have found it to raise trillions of dollars. Whether or not the Joint Committee on Tax, which is the official budget scorekeeper for tax proposals passed by Congress, agrees with those outside estimates is an entirely different matter. They have their own estimators, they have their own models, and they tend to come up with, you know, their own numbers, and that is the nonpartisan number that you really have to go by. So you really can't rely too much on what outside folks say it's going to raise.
Have we seen a precedent for this idea of a wealth tax here in the United States?
I think that the precedent is really for raising marginal tax rates on the wealthy. When the individual income tax was first instituted in the early 20th century, it was really targeted to the wealthiest people, and only the wealthy paid individual income taxes. Now, add in a couple of world wars and, you know, a Great Depression, and suddenly Congress had began to expand who had to pay taxes beyond just the incredibly wealthy to everybody. And then the advent of Social Security and Medicare, you had to start to increase other taxes for payroll taxes to pay for those programs. But in general, I think that, that the idea that the wealthiest should pay their fair share or more than everyone else is something that has general acceptance among the American population.
We're talking to Caroline Bruckner, Managing Director of American University's Tax Policy Center, looking at the latest proposals to increase or decrease taxes on the wealthiest Americans. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the wealthiest Americans should be paying more in taxes? If so, what do you think is the best way to do that? A higher tax rates, a wealth tax, something else? Or if you think looking to the rich for more tax revenue is a bad idea, let us know why. Let us know what you want to see happen. Or do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation and take a look at the estate tax coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Caroline Bruckner, Managing Director of the COGOD Tax Policy Center at American University. We're talking about different proposals out there when it comes to taxes on the wealthiest Americans. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think taxes should go up for wealthier Americans? Why or why not? How should taxes be raised or lowered? What's your proposal? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Caroline, before we go to our callers, I wanted to get into the estate tax. It was trimmed back some in the big Republican tax plan. Mitch McConnell talking about getting rid of it. Senator Bernie Sanders saying, nope, raise the estate tax rates. What's the estate tax? Who pays it now?
Well, so as part of tax reform for years 2018 through 2025, an individual can exempt from estate tax up to $11.2 million of their estate, and a married couple, that doubles for a married couple, so $22.4 million. And what that translates to is in 2018, as a result of this change, about 5,000 estates were projected to pay estate tax, and that number dropped down to about 1,700 estates in the country would now actually have to pay taxes on the estate taxes because they were above those exemption levels.
Then, apart from the individual types of taxes, people raise concerns about loopholes and ways to get around paying taxes, all legal in most cases, I think. Is that something people are looking at, closing what are so-called loopholes?
I think that people are looking at closing loopholes, but where I think people should be looking is the fact that there's an annual non-filing tax gap of $4 billion. And more often than not, especially when it comes to, individuals, there's an actual, underreporting of, for example, payroll taxes by self-employed folks of $65 billion. So rather than having to, raise taxes or create new taxes, if you just target folks that are not filing or underreporting, you raise quite a bit of money.
Let's go to our callers now. Tyler is with us in Fitchburg. Tyler, hi.
Hi. My two observations. Without enough taxes, our government, needs to borrow ever more money, encumbering ever more debt, and having to pay interest on the debt. So without sufficient tax income, the government is already $21 trillion in debt. Second point, corporate taxes have been reduced for probably decades. No wonder the government is basically bankrupt. Sorry to point this out, but these are issues that need to be discussed with the public.
Tyler, thanks a lot for the call. So, Caroline, insufficient tax collection, Tyler says, is the big culprit in the deficit. Obviously, it's income and output, too, but how right is he or wrong?
He actually makes a good point. Keep in mind that in 2017, we had an annual deficit, which is the difference between how much money we take in through tax collection and how much we spend. That was about $665 billion for 2017. CBO just put out a new report that projects in the coming years the annual deficit is going to be $1.2 trillion. And a lot of that is attributable to the tax cut bill that we passed in December of 2017 that took effect for 2018. And with respect to his point on corporate taxes, there's something to that. In 2017, corporations paid roughly $300 billion of corporate taxes. And this year, they're going to pay CBO is projecting that in 2019, they'll pay $205 billion. That's $100 billion less than they would have paid otherwise because the tax reform bill cut the corporate tax rate from 35% down to 21%.
Thanks for that call. And before we go back to our callers, the general argument in favor of tax cuts, or an argument in favor of tax cuts, is, okay, by not taking this money out of the economy, we're encouraging productive businesses. That's going to grow the economy long term anyway. That's going to bring in more taxes than if we just raise the taxes now. Is there anything to that?
I think that CBO's most recent publication on their budget outlook for 2019 and moving onward shows that they are projecting actually economic growth is going to slow, that the spike that the economy got as a result of the tax cut bill in 2018, it has now started to fizzle out, and that economic output growth is going to slow. And that could be really problematic.
Go to another caller now. Bill is with us in Waukesha. Bill, hello.
Hello.
Hi, what'd you want to bring up, Bill?
Well, I generally support a flat tax, but I agree with your guest that the public probably feels the very wealthiest need to contribute more. But my problem with that is they probably use fewer services than people who are in the lower income. And so it, as a matter of fairness, it's really not fair to make them cover for the behavior of others, such as, you know, people having children out of wedlock, whatever. But a flat tax is, in my opinion, the fairest form of tax, because everybody would be equally invested in seeing that, you know, things are run properly, that their taxes aren't spent incorrectly. And where it is now, if you tax the very wealthy at a certain rate, they're going to hide their money somehow, end up not paying taxes. We have multiple examples of the very wealthiest in Wisconsin doing that.
Bill, I'm going to jump in. You gave us a lot there. Bill saying a flat tax is a fair tax, Caroline.
You know, the American public has wrestled with questions over whether to switch from a progressive tax system to a flat tax over the decades since the individual income tax was instituted in the early 20th century. And when you talk to tax historians like Joe Thorndike and others, they'll tell you that when flat tax proposals got really popular, each and every time the American public has rejected it as being fundamentally unfair. If you think about it, 35% of $10,000 to someone that's only making $10,000 is so much more than 35% to someone that's making $200,000. It's the difference in some instances between being able to feed yourself and not. And those basic arguments against the proportionality of what a flat tax means to lower income earners and how that's viewed typically by the American public as being unfair really hasn't won over enough people to support a flat tax.
Thanks a lot for that call, Bill. We're talking to Caroline Bruckner from American University, looking at different proposals out there when it comes to taxing wealthier Americans. Let's go to another caller now. Let's go to Meg in Northern Illinois. Meg, hi.
Hi. So thank you so much for taking my call. I just want to put in a plug for the estate tax. I feel like having unlimited amounts of money passed down through families generation after generation ends up building an aristocracy and a lot of power in the hands of a few, and that ends up being bad for democracy.
Meg, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Caroline, as I dimly recall, some of the founders of the United States had that same concern, not so much an economic issue, but that too much power would be concentrated without an estate tax.
I think that the estate tax is certainly one key way, by not having an estate tax, that you can centralize wealth in the hands of a few. I think that, you know, the estate tax, as recently as 2000, was only allowed for an exemption level of $675,000 per estate, and, you know, 52,000 estates paid that tax. Today, only 1,700 are going to pay that tax. It certainly reflects a consolidation and a centralization of wealth. It could be viewed as a consolidation. On the other hand, this is a fairly easy tax to administer because it's of the required filings and the ease of measuring it. And it just seems to me that if we are in need of revenue, that might be one place to look. Because keep in mind, when we doubled the exemption level as part of tax reform from $5 million to $11 million as part of tax reform, that cost American taxpayers $83 billion.
Now, one concern about the estate tax that is raised when people talk about getting rid of it is that, okay, if you have a large enough family farm or ranch, for a while people talk about publishing outfits, family businesses, basically, the estate tax can force families to dismantle those. Is that still a concern?
Well, it might have been in 2000 when the exemption level was $675,000, but, you know, the most recent estimates I've seen on the small businesses or closely held businesses and small farms that are impacted, a grand total of 80 were impacted under the projections for the estate tax at the $5 million exemption threshold in 2017.
Let's bring on one more caller. Randy is with us in Ripon. Randy, hello.
Hi. A little of my background here, I'm a self-employed carpenter. I can tell you, a self-employed, at least not for me, I'm not getting rich at this. I don't even know if I'll be able to keep my house. So a number of years ago, I read a book by Bill Gates Sr. and the heir to the Meyer family fortune, and they brought up the argument that they should be paying more taxes, and their wealth is a benefit. They made their wealth off our investment in education, infrastructure, and all, you know, a military protecting our corporate assets and all these things, and that they have an obligation to pay more because, according to this book, Gates said he pays.
What I'm going to jump in, Randy, because we just have a few moments left. Caroline, in our last 30 seconds, is there a basic fairness issue here?
I think that there are a lot of extremely wealthy people in this country that are willing to pay more in taxes. I think on the other side of that, there are other, very wealthy folks who say that they pay more than enough. And I think that politicians are looking at right now is just that general polling that has come out in recent days showing that, by and large, the American public is very supportive of increasing taxes on the incredibly wealthy.
Caroline, thanks a lot for joining us today. That was Caroline Bruckner from American University looking at taxes and wealthy Americans. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Several unions have filed a lawsuit against the state over the lame duck laws passed in December. Coming up, we look at that and the other two legal challenges against the legislation. First, the state of Massachusetts has filed a civil complaint against Purdue Pharma. That's the drug company that makes the opioid painkiller OxyContin. Documents from the complaint shed light on how the company responded to growing evidence of addiction and overdoses. One strategy Purdue considered was moving into the market of addiction treatment. This case is one of many ongoing suits against opioid manufacturers, and it comes at a time when drug makers are under scrutiny for their marketing of addictive painkillers, which some public health experts say fueled a rise in overdose deaths from opioid drugs. David Armstrong is a senior reporter at ProPublica, specializing in healthcare investigations. He's been reporting on this. David, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Before we get into the latest on the case, give us a little background on the company Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family.
Well, sure. I mean, to most people until recently, Purdue Pharma was not a well-recognized name or brand. It's a family-owned, family-controlled, privately held business. And it was started, you know, basically in the 1950s by three brothers. And their early products were things like laxatives and antibacterial products. You know, not big sellers. And it wasn't until 1996 when they launched OxyContin that Purdue Pharma became a multi-billion-dollar pharmaceutical concern. And that continued right up until recently where we've seen a decline in OxyContin prescribing, but years and years of billion-dollar-plus sales of this drug, and that has gone on to make the family one of the wealthiest in the country.
And we have this lawsuit now taking place, I think, in Massachusetts. What is at the heart of that?
Well, the Massachusetts lawsuit is a little different than the lawsuits you've seen elsewhere. And, you know, just to give you a quick background on the legal landscape, there's hundreds and hundreds of lawsuits pending right now against Purdue Pharma. They've been filed by cities and counties and private concerns as well. So they do really face a very serious litigation threat. The Massachusetts lawsuit's unique both in its detail and also by the fact that they are individually going after Sackler family members. There's eight members of the family named in the complaint. And that's what's really different. The basic argument by Massachusetts is the money that's been realized by the Sackler families on an individual basis is ill-gotten. It was the result of falsely marketing and deceptively marketing OxyContin. And so that's what they're going after. They're going after not only the money that the company has, but the money that has been flowed directly to the family.
And in filings in this case, and this is a lot of what your and other reporting has covered, we're learning a lot about the level of involvement from the Sackler family in the strategies that Purdue Pharma used to market OxyContin. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's right. These were not passive owners. You know, they were not people who just sort of got a check in the mail every couple months and sort of enjoyed it and spent it. They were very involved, the records are showing, in the management of the company. You had members of the family who served in executive positions, but probably more importantly, they constituted the majority of the board of directors. And what the documents uncovered by Massachusetts have shown is that they had a very high level of direct involvement in things like, how do we market this drug? And, you know, down to the level of, what are the bonuses for salespeople going to be comprised of? Pushing for higher doses, describing how this drug works. All of these details the family was very involved with, according to these documents. Perhaps most involved is Richard Sackler, who was chairman of the board for many years and also served as president of the company. He was so involved that some of the executives of the company were appealing to higher-ups to limit his involvement because he would call them at night, weekends. He demanded material at all hours of the day, and it was becoming too much.
What kind of tactics did Purdue Pharma use to boost sales of OxyContin and higher doses of OxyContin?
Well, they did a number of things. They targeted the doctors who wrote the highest level of prescriptions for painkillers. They found through research, some of it was provided by McKinsey and Company, you know, the world famous consulting company was employed by Purdue for a number of years to help them what they called turbocharge OxyContin sales. So they found that the doctors who prescribed most often were the ones to target because you could get their levels up. Not only would they prescribe more than lower prescribers, but they would prescribe at higher doses. And that's important for Purdue because the higher dose pills were the most profitable. So that's what they did. They also, you know, there was a campaign to sort of downplay the addictive nature of OxyContin. You know, this is a new kind of painkiller. It was more potent than painkillers have seen before because it was supposed to last for 12 hours. So the active ingredient in it, which is oxycodone, was put in there at a much higher level than we had seen with other painkillers in the past. So there's a real effort to, you know, sort of limit concern about addiction, and also to portray the people who became addicted to the drug as, in the words of Richard Sackler in an email, reckless criminals. And, you know, that's what a lot of people have found offensive in these emails and documents.
We're talking to David Armstrong from ProPublica, talking about his reporting on Purdue Pharma, a big court case going on with that company right now, about how they handled marketing of their premier product, OxyContin. David, some of the materials from these court filings had been redacted until very recently. Now more of them are out, and you report that Purdue Pharma was looking at a new product line, addiction treatment. Talk about that a little, please.
Yeah, this is pretty extraordinary if you think about it, because OxyContin and the marketing of it has been blamed by a lot of public health experts for seeding and kicking off the opioid crisis that we deal with now and that everyone is by this point in time, unfortunately, is very familiar with. And the sort of consequence of that was efforts to regulate prescribing of these really potent painkillers. you know, the number of prescriptions written just skyrocketed after 1996 and only recently began to slow down. But because of increased awareness of the risk of this drug and increased regulation, OxyContin sales have slowed. So what did Purdue Pharma do? Well, they explored getting into sort of the other side of the curve here, and that's addiction treatment. In other words, offering medication, offering services to people who had, in some cases, become addicted to their other product. And so they did explore this in recently, a secret project called Project Tango. They didn't go ahead with it, at least not yet, but it was interesting how they explored this marketplace and also what they had to say about it.
And what did they have to say about it?
Well, you know, as I mentioned earlier, they were very harsh in their assessment in earlier years when they were marketing OxyContin and trying to drive sales of that higher in terms of the people who became addicted to the drug. When they were looking at the addiction treatment market, it was a much softer tone, a much more understanding tone that they took when looking at the people who were suffering from substance use disorders related to opioids. So they said things like, this could happen to anyone, a 50-year-old woman with chronic lower back pain or an 18-year-old boy with a sports injury. And they said it could happen to the wealthy and to the very poor, and that this is an underserved, stigmatized population. That language is just so diametrically opposed to what they said earlier. And again, you know, for people who are in this industry, working in the front lines, treating people, this was really something that took them aback.
What has Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family had to say about accusations that they over-aggressively marketed OxyContin?
Well, they've largely denied them, outside of the fact that in 2007, Purdue Pharma and three executives, all not members of the Sackler family, admitted to misleading marketing of OxyContin, and the company itself paid a $600 million fine. Outside of that, you know, Purdue has said this has been a rush to vilify and that the Massachusetts prosecutors have selectively taken, you know, very misleading tidbits from the documents in an effort to, you know, portray the company as really something of a monster here. And you know, they think it's unfair, and they think this is a more complicated crisis that we're dealing with, and that to the extent the company played a role, well, it was one of many factors involved.
What is the current status of this court case in Massachusetts now?
So that's a good question. It's a pending case. Massachusetts has decided to go it a little bit differently than a lot of the other governmental agencies, most of which have a consolidated case in federal court in Ohio. Massachusetts is pushing forward with their own case in Massachusetts state court. But, you know, they've won a number of these early rulings, such as unredacting the complaint. I mean, this complaint is nearly 300 pages and was largely redacted. And now, except for one paragraph, it has been unredacted. So that was something Purdue fought and didn't want out there, and Massachusetts won on that score. So, you know, it's moving towards a trial. Purdue, as far as I know, has not faced a trial related to the marketing of OxyContin. So, you know, we'll see if that happens or if it's settled in some fashion or, you know, I guess ultimately could be dismissed as well.
And is this a case where it might not just be Purdue Pharma as a corporate entity, but individuals in the Sackler family itself that could be, economically liable?
Yeah, in fact, Massachusetts is looking to recoup from the family some of the money it realized in profits from OxyContin. You know, arguing that this money was ill-gotten, that it was based on illegal deceptive marketing, and that people in Massachusetts and the government itself are in line to recoup some of that money to, you know, pay for the cost of this crisis. And that's, again, that's what's sort of novel about this case. I mean, we'll see. I mean, they've also sued some of the board members, these independent board members, if you will, non-family members, who, according to Massachusetts, not once in hundreds of board votes ever went against the family. So we'll see. I mean, that is what's happening here, and it's the first time that I know of where a state has gone directly after the family members.
And as we wrap up, David, is the revealing of this information about how they marketed these drugs, is this raising wider red flags about drug marketing from pharmaceutical companies via doctors?
Well, I think it just adds to the concern that's already out there. I mean, the last 10-15 years, we've come to learn a lot more about the way in which drug companies market to doctors. And, you know, there's been some efforts to more closely regulate that and limit the interactions and limit the kinds of things that, you know, drug companies can do financially related to doctors. But it does show you the precision in which doctors were targeted. And one of the things that's really interesting, I think, about the Purdue documents is, you know, they found that the more they visited doctors, the more they prescribed. There was a direct correlation. And McKinsey helped them with this analysis as well. And they wanted sales reps literally in doctors' offices, the same doctor, every week if they were a high prescriber. And they and each sales rep had a quota of more than 1,000 doctor visits a year. So this is essentially what they were doing every day, was going doctor to doctor to doctor.
David, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
David Armstrong is a senior reporter at ProPublica, specializing in healthcare investigations. He was with us to talk about a civil complaint in Massachusetts against the company Purdue Pharma and what we're finding out about how that company marketed the painkiller OxyContin. Coming up, we'll take a look at the lawsuits challenging Wisconsin's lame duck laws. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says millennials are feeling exhaustion and burnout as a way of life. Find out why and share your experiences. Right now, a coalition of labor groups has filed a lawsuit against the lame duck laws Republicans passed before Governor Evers took office. That marks now the third legal challenge against some or all of the legislation. These laws impose new limits on certain powers held by Evers and fellow Democrat Josh Call, now Attorney General. Republicans say the moves are about balancing power between the executive and legislative branches. Democrats say they were a last-ditch power grab in an attempt to undercut the November elections. Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, remind us the high points here of what these lame duck laws did.
I guess we're pretty broad, but I think the pieces that are being challenged in these lawsuits really focus on the restrictions that these new laws imposed upon Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General Josh Call. One of the things that's getting a lot of attention, not only in the press, but in these lawsuits now, is a new restriction that prevents Evers and Call from deciding when to get into and out of federal lawsuits. So the Affordable Care Act lawsuit, that's something that they both ran on getting the state out of. They can't do that now under one of the lame duck laws. Another provision that's getting some attention in these lawsuits is all the restrictions. It is a bunch of restrictions on Evers when it comes to administrative rulemaking. And a lot of that now has to go before the legislature to get their okay. This is something that the unions filing this lawsuit yesterday say could grind government to a halt.
Right. Let's talk about this newest lawsuit here, a group of unions. Who is suing here and why?
So you got kind of a long list of plaintiffs here who's suing. You've got Service Employees International Union, SEIU, SEIU Healthcare Wisconsin, Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers, AFT Wisconsin, Wisconsin Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals. Also, a state senator is among the plaintiffs, Janet Bewley. And so they are all saying that the lame duck session amounted to a violation of the state constitution's protections of separation of powers. So it's taking too much power away from the executive branch, they say, giving the legislature too much of a check over the executive. So they've said that, you know, it's always been a right of executives, governors in Wisconsin, to decide when to get into and out of litigation, like the Affordable Care Act lawsuit. And the new restrictions have created kind of chaos when it comes to that. There's uncertainty about how to get into and out of that. And then they really do drill down on these provisions that restrict Evers' ability to write administrative rules, saying that, you know, that's going to have repercussions that are both expensive and confusing, that you're going to have a government that's not responsive.
Why unions? Why are they the ones filing these suits?
I think, I'm not certain, but it's not unusual to see unions be adversaries in an organized way against, you know, Republicans in this case. They've had a long history of kind of going back and forth with Republicans over the last 8 years over laws that they passed. And so in this case, I don't think it's surprising to see them band together to hire lawyers to fight the lame duck laws.
And what's the venue on this one?
This one is in Dane County Circuit Court. So that is in the state court system, which means that it would ultimately be appealed up to the state Supreme Court, you know, if it got that far, where conservatives have a 4-3 majority.
Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief, looking at lawsuits against legislation passed in the lame duck session late last year. Sean, it's one of now three lining up. Let's talk about the other ones. One in federal court, more specific to voting regulations, right?
Right. And this one is kind of an offshoot of a 2016 case where Judge James Peterson struck down early voting restrictions in Wisconsin, along with a number of other Republican-authored voting laws. Essentially, what James Peterson said in this case is, look, I struck these laws down before. You passed a new law that's almost exactly the same, and he blocked it again. So that federal case was already in the court system. It's actually been appealed a couple of years ago to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, but the Seventh Circuit never did anything with that case. So it's still in the hands of Judge James Peterson, and he said, look, I'm blocking this law again. It's similar to what I blocked before, and you can't do this.
And then the third one, we've talked about this, the Wisconsin League of Women Voters and other groups. They're filing a challenge to the whole package, not on the merits, not on the outcome of these laws, as I understand it, but on the procedure. They're saying, in effect, this never happened because the session wasn't convened right.
Yeah, exactly. And so this one is also filed in Dane County Circuit Court. And so you've got two cases now. You've got the union case and you have the League of Women Voters case that are both in circuit court. But I think you can kind of sort them out by looking at the union's case as suing these laws on the merit. You asked why unions would sue. They did reference how that this these changes will make it harder for working people to accomplish their goals in state government. And that Governor Evers was the candidate that they supported, and, you know, that they should be able to see the result of that election, transpire in state government. So the union case is on the merits. It's a separation of powers case. The other case, the League of Women Voters case, is strictly procedural. It says that there's nothing in the Wisconsin Constitution that says the state legislature can convene in extraordinary session. They did that. And so anything that they passed in that extraordinary session is unlawful. An extraordinary session is a session called by legislative leaders. It's happened a couple dozen times since about 1980. Normally, typically over the history of the state, the way that the legislature would convene in these sessions that aren't scheduled would be in a special session called by the governor. So this is something that they say hasn't been tested before in the court system, and they're going to test it now.
As of right now, all of the stuff passed in the lame duck session is in effect, right, Sean, except for that one specific voting issue in the federal court.
Correct. The voting provision, there's also some stuff that Judge Peterson struck down having to do with the ID petition process, or the process that people use when they go to get an ID for voting. That has all been struck down in that federal court ruling. But these two state cases that want to take down everything that was passed in the lame duck session, they are, you know, very much in their early stages. I think there's a scheduling conference for the League of Women Voters case next week. But there have been no rulings in those cases. There have been, no hearings in those cases, really. And so they're just at their beginnings.
Any rumblings that there might be more lawsuits waiting in the wings out there, Sean?
I haven't heard rumblings, but I wouldn't be surprised. I think one thing that people were watching for, after this League of Women Voters case was filed and says that, procedurally, you can't have extraordinary sessions in Wisconsin. At that point, I think a lot of people were thinking we still have another case to come, because there's been a lot of Democrats have talked a lot about how this is a separation of powers issue, how you're giving the legislature too much of veto power over the executive, or the governor in this case. So now that this case is here, that will be argued in the state courts. Wouldn't be surprised to see another one, but we don't have one right now.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief. We talked with him about the lawsuits, three of them now, related to the lame duck laws Republicans passed before Governor Tony Evers took office. Sean and the rest of the news team will be tracking the progress of those lawsuits as they move forward. If you're a Wisconsinite who likes bratwurst, a lot of those out there, here's the perfect vacation getaway for you. A butcher in Germany has opened a sausage-themed bed and breakfast just outside the city of Nuremberg. The Bubel Bratwurst Bed and Breakfast features sausage-themed wallpaper and a lot of other sausage-themed decorations. Ah, and the menu. The owner says, "I serve not steaks with onions, I serve bratwurst with onions. I serve not the German schnitzel, I serve bratwurst schnitzel. I serve many different styles of bratwurst with chili, with horseradish, or with chocolate or coffee inside." Getting some negative reactions here in the studio to that last one. Okay, so there's your dream bratwurst vacation. Cook thought, I was lucky enough to go to Germany in my youth for just a few days in Bavaria, and I was at a restaurant, and I knew some German. On the restaurant was something called Wurst salad. Wurst. Sausage, salad. I figure, okay, got a nice green salad, some sliced up sausage, bratwurst, I don't know what, in it. Comes to the table, I order it, comes to the table. It is not a salad with sausage, it is a salad of sausage. Four different kinds of German sausage mixed with vinegar and onions. I mean, sounds like a pretty good snack. Wasn't exactly the half-healthy meal I was looking for. Let me know if you check out the Bratwurst Bed and Breakfast in Germany. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.